This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. George Harrison was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this week, 1 year and 3 months after his death from cancer. My guest is his widow, Olivia Harrison. They were married in 1978, shortly after the birth of their son. They met in 1974 when Olivia was working for A&M Records, which was then distributing George's record label, Dark Horse. Now all of his Dark Horse recordings from 1976 to 92 have been reissued in a new box set, which includes liner notes by Olivia Harrison. Although Dark Horse was George's place to develop his musical identity away from the Beatles, several of the songs he wrote for the Beatles, Something, Taxman, and If I Needed Someone, are included in the box set on the reissued recording of his 1991 concert in Japan. Olivia Harrison, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like to start by asking you to choose a favorite record of yours from the new box set. I know that's probably a hard choice to make, but if you can choose a favorite, or if this helps narrow it down, if there's a song that your husband wrote about you that you could choose.
Well, there's a song he wrote about our son when he was born that I really love, and it's become a favorite once again. It's called Unknown Delight. And it's on the Gontrapo album.
Well, let's hear it.
Darkest, deep brown eyes I've seen. Angel came into my dream. Like the morning's early light. Refreshing all.
That's Unknown Delight, a song dedicated to George Harrison and Olivia Harrison's son, and it's one of the many tracks on the new box set, George Harrison, The Dark Horse Years. What are some of the things that he felt he could do musically on his own that he couldn't do when he was with the Beatles?
Oh, probably an enormous amount, and I think they probably all of them felt like that. But for George, he... Recently, I saw him on an interview saying that he had a quota, you know, a couple songs on each album. And he said it would have taken me about 100 Beatle albums to do the songs that he'd already written back, you know, in the 60s. Could have been an exaggeration. But, you know, they were just tremendous songwriters and a lot of material. And, you know, on his own, he was able to just really express himself.
Did that bother him that on the Beatles album... Beatles albums for him, there was a quota?
It wasn't really, I don't think it was an official quota, but, you know, I mean, really, John and Paul's,
right,
you know,
right.
But, you know, had an incredible amount of material. George, he was, you know, he began writing a little bit later, you know, everybody knows that, but he had a lot of material. He probably would have recorded more of his own songs than their albums if he did, if they'd have not been so prolific.
The new box set includes some demo recordings that weren't on the original albums when they were released. And I'd like to play one of those. Maybe that'll give us some insights into his songwriting process by hearing something before it was, you know, like produced in the studio. So this is his song, Here Comes the Moon, which I believe he wrote on a vacation in Hawaii.
That's right. That's right, actually. It was in Hana. That was a big moon rising from behind this sort of rock island. Big pink blue sky and a big full moon rising. And he thought, you know, I don't know why I haven't written this one. You know, he really was a sun and moon man. You know, he was quite into the planets. They inspired him. And the moon inspired him.
This is kind of his answer song to Here Comes the Sun.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so this is a demo recording. George Harrison, Here Comes the Moon.
Everybody's talking up the storm. Act like they don't notice it, but here it is. he come the moon, the moon, the moon, the moon, the moon. He comes the moon, the moon, the moon, the moon, the moon. Oh yeah.
That's George Harrison and his demo recording of Here Comes the Moon. It's included on the new box set, George Harrison, The Dark Horse Years. My guest is George Harrison's widow, Olivia Harrison. And that's just one of several demo recordings that he made that's included on the box set. Do you have any others you want to refer to?
You know, there was that demo of Mystical One. I don't know if you listen to that. You can hear we were in St. Bart's, I think. You can hear the rain in the background. There's kind of a funny humming in the back, and it was just pouring with rain. And I found that cassette not so long ago. And, you know, it's all, the whole tape's not on there, but you hear him playing a few chords, a few more chords. And then he says, "Liv, have you got a piece of paper and a pencil?" And he's literally writing it right then. And then on the cassette, you'll hear him. He just plays it right through for the first time.
Why don't we actually hear that moment in which he is talking to you on that demo recording?
Great.
You get a bit of paper and a pen, maybe? Yeah, I'll have one of them. I can write on one of them, limited to... There's a wonky one on the top, on the bottom of the floor. Oh, you didn't give those ones I did to Brian. Is that one off-center?
Yeah, one. About the pen. I don't know, I think it's okay.
That's George Harrison and his demo recording of his song Mystical One, and it's included on his new box set, George Harrison, The Dark Horse Years, 1976 to 1992. My guest is his widow, Olivia Harrison. You lived together in a 120-room mansion that was built in the late 1800s on 30 acres of land about an hour and a half outside London. Did that give you the sense of privacy that you wanted?
Well, first of all, I get a chance to clear up that rumor that there are 120 rooms in that house. George and I used to laugh about that because, I mean, I think Buckingham Palace might have 120 rooms, but there was nowhere near that amount. So, you know, every time we would hear that, we'd think, why do people keep saying that? We can just clear that up right now. It's nowhere near that.
How many were there?
I think we've got maybe sort of six bedrooms. You know, I'm not going to say how many rooms altogether because there's a studio and, you know, a couple of kitchens. Maybe there's 30 rooms, but there's certainly not 120. But, I certainly didn't need privacy until I, you know, met George. But he sure did. And he moved there because... He'd had to move out of London, and then he moved into the country in Surrey, and then that became sort of known, and then he moved to Friar Park, and in the end, you know, a lot of people came there too, but it was a way that he could be outside, be in a garden, and not be bothered.
How did you meet?
I worked at his record company, Dark Horse Records, in Los Angeles, And I actually, you know, talked to him before we met. And I don't know, we just got along. You know, I think we had similar spiritual ideas. I think that was the main thing, really.
In what ways were they similar?
Well, I mean, we were both into meditation and vegetarians, and you know, our priorities and goals in life were similar. And I think that was it, really.
Were you concerned when you started being together that you weren't enough the trophy wife? Well, I guess when you're that famous, you don't need a trophy wife per se, but so many famous people marry like the supermodel or the already famous celebrity actress, or you know what I mean? Like sometimes celebrities are matched with other celebrities, and you weren't famous. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that was the whole point.
He wanted somebody who wasn't,
you know, that was the whole
coming
point,
with all those trappings. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he was a normal, you know, George. That's the thing. He was like this icon of our generation, and you know, definitely, and famous person. But he was a normal person who had other goals in life, you know, spiritual goals, and who had had a good, you know, family life, and you know, he'd had a lot of fun, and he'd done a lot of things, and I think that was part of the attraction, I believe.
Do you think that all of the fame and the money of the Beatles years in a way drove your husband to seek spirituality even more so than he might have otherwise, to find some kind of larger meaning beyond the fame and money?
You know, I found a letter that George wrote to his mother when he was like, he was must have been filming Help, 69 I think it must have been. He was young. He was at the height of, you know, Beatles success. And he wrote a letter to his mother about meditation, trying to explain to her what they were doing, you know, with the Maharishi. And it's so profound, you know. He says, you know, it's only natural for people to want to find more happiness and intelligence and peace. And this is what we're doing. And maybe we can do this so that other people will be able to learn it, and then they won't have to go through all the madness that that seems to be going on today. And he's writing this, and he's in his mid-20s. And he said, when I was a kid, I knew I was going to be a success. He said, I couldn't have proved it, but it was just a feeling that I had. And now I know that I'm going to reach the real top, the highest thing that a man can attain. And all I have to do is believe in myself and keep that feeling. And he said that the highest thing that a man can attain, which is self-realization. So he was in his mid-20s. He was at the height of success. I mean, any young man would have been forgiven for thinking that that was about as great as life can get. And yet George already at that age knew that that wasn't it, that that wasn't the highest at all. So, I mean, very early on, you know, George realized that.
I know that your husband did a lot to support the Hare Krishna movement while he was alive, and in giving them a generous amount of money that he bequeathed them after his death. But was that like the only path that he himself followed during most of his life, or did he have like several different directions that he headed in with his own meditation?
Well, first of all, it's not accurate that he left a lot of money to the Hare Krishnas. So,
oh, okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Correct me.
Yeah,
I already left them like $20 million or something.
Yeah, yeah. He did read that, but that wasn't actually true. You know, George wanted to support anyone that was dedicating time or helping people to have a better understanding of their purpose of life. And that included transcendental meditation, Vedantist, Self-Realization Fellowship, the Hare Krishna movement, you know, anyone who had a desire to find out something of a more spiritual nature, George was really ready to support. I mean, not everything. He didn't tolerate kooks much, you know, but he thought that schools should teach yoga, should teach people how to live. They thought that in education they weren't teaching children things that really would help them with their internal life.
Something that surprised me, which maybe I should have known about, on the, one of the CDs on the new box set, one of the reissued recordings, has two Hoagy Carmichael songs on it, Hong Kong Blues and Baltimore Oriole. And it made me wonder, what was the musical life like around the house when your husband was alive? What kind of records did he play around the house?
We played everything, a lot of ethnic music. I mean, when I first came to Friar Park, you know, there was a jukebox there. There were two jukeboxes. And there was everything from Christmas carols on the sitar to the Singing Postman to Hank Williams to Lead Belly, the Platters, and Chuck Berry and Buddy Holly and the Goons, you know.
George from the Goon Show.
From the Goon Show. He had, like, the producers. He had, like, all sorts of things on this jukebox. It really confused me when I first arrived, I have to say.
Why did that confuse you?
Well, I mean, I'd never really heard the Goons before.
Oh, I see.
Suddenly
I see.
He puts on I'm Walking Backwards for Christmas across the Irish Sea. You know, I mean, it doesn't really mean much to somebody from California. So, you know, he loved things that made him laugh, and he loved really good music. He loved Hoagy Carmichael as a songwriter, and Cab Calloway he was quite fond of, you know, or the Ink Spots, or Big Bill Brunsey and the Bulgarian Choir. He loved them. In fact, they came and performed for us once.
Well, let me play something from the new box set that is an old R&B song that that your husband covered. And it's called Got My Mind Set on You. Did he talk to you about why he liked this song so much?
Yeah, it was just a song that was always around in his head that he'd heard, you know, in the 60s. And I think because in Liverpool, they used to get a lot of records, you know, it was a seaport. And there used to be a lot of records from America that came over in Brian Epstein's record store. And again, that was one of them. And it was just something that stayed in his head, and he... Jim Keltner was over once playing a drum pattern, and one of the guys said, oh, you know, that sounds like Set on You. And he said, yeah, let's do that. It was just a song that he'd had in his head, you know, never left him.
Mm-hmm. Well, why don't we hear it? And this has Got My Mind Set on You, originally recorded by James Ray. This is George Harrison, one of the many tracks included on the new George Harrison box set, The Dark Horse Years, 1976 to 1992. George Harrison, one of the tracks included on his new box set, The Dark Horse Years, 1976 to 1992. My guest is his widow, Olivia Harrison. You know, we were talking before a little about spirituality, and I think, you know, religion, spirituality, whether you're following something that's organized or following something that's just more inner and self-directed, in a lot of ways, it's something that prepares you for death, because all spirituality and religion tries to find some meaning or some place in life. And that is all, in a way, about preparing you for the inevitability of your own death and for kind of accepting your place in this world, which ultimately, no matter how big, is kind of small. So I'm wondering if you think that your husband's immersion in spirituality helped prepare him for his relatively early death.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole point, really. That's what you practice all your life, is you know, how high will you leap? Will you make enough for you to reap it? Only you'll arrive at your own made end with no one but yourself to be offended. It's you that decides. Those are the lyrics to Run of the Mill. I mean, you know, don't forget George wrote The Art of Dying, I know, back in 1970. So yes, I mean, of course, that was, he once said, you can't just practice at the end of your life, because, you know, you're likely to be in pain and whatever. So you have to practice all your life. You have to remember God, because whatever you remember most in your life is what you're going to think of when you're dying. And I, for one, he said, don't want to be thinking, did I put the cat out? And, you know, he really meant that. He didn't want to be having to think about, oh, dear, did I do this? Did I do that? He wanted to be ready. And that wasn't just the last part of his life. That was is, you know, from very, very early on.
Well, pain can be a mighty distraction from all focused thought and all higher thought. Do you feel like he was able to hold on to the kinds of thoughts he wanted to hold on to in spite of all of the discomfort and weakness brought on not only by the cancer but probably by the treatment of the cancer, although, frankly, I don't really know which treatments he used?
George was pretty, you know, I think... He is pretty transcendental guy, and I, you know, I don't have any doubt that he was consciously doing what he'd practiced. And I say that because, you know, and I don't really ever talk about it, but, you know, maybe it'll inspire others. But when he was attacked in 1999, you know, he was literally being murdered. And he said that at a particular point in time, he thought, that's it. You know, I'm being murdered in my own home. And he said, at that point, I thought, well, I better start remembering God, because that's what you're supposed to do. And that, even though I'd known George half of my life, you know, when we talked about that, it just doubled my respect for him, because I wasn't thinking about that. I wasn't thinking about God, really. But he was. And now, if you can do it under those circumstances, then you can do it if you're in a peaceful environment with people supporting you, helping you, if that's what your goal is. And that's what his was.
Well, I should think that your thoughts at that moment weren't about God. Your thoughts at that moment, while he was thinking about God, was, what can I do to save my husband's life, which you accomplished. I mean, you got, well, like an iron from the fireplace or something and beat the guy?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't thinking of that. I just wasn't thinking of anything. It wasn't anything, certainly wasn't any thought. It just, you just do. You know, what you have to do. I mean, some people, I was lucky I did that. Some people might not have done it, but, you know.
I'm one of those people who always wonders, you know, people say your instincts kick in, and I always wonder, do I have any instincts like that? Would they kick in?
Believe me.
Yeah.
They're primal. It's a primal thing. You know, I don't think so. I mean, your instinct is to run away. Your instinct is to, like, I don't want to do this. Uh-huh. I know, who wants to hurt anybody? Nobody. But I think there is instinct, in the true sense of the word, is really primeval. It's not just about your conditioning. For me, anyway, it went beyond conditioning of this lifetime to some DNA primal survival thing.
And then was he unconscious or did he run away?
Oh, he finally fell down.
Uh-huh. And then called the police or the ambulance?
No, we'd already done that early on.
Oh.
I'd already phoned the police. But in the meantime, you know, you try and fight somebody for 8 or 10 or 12 minutes. It's a pretty long time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So were you hurt?
Yeah, I had my head cracked open.
Can I ask you something? You know, people always ask themselves, no matter how liberal their views are about, you know, the death penalty and punishment and things like that, if something happens to them or to someone they love, that would somehow be a test of what their real beliefs are. What did you wish for this man who, from what I've read, sounds like he was mentally ill?
You know, it's funny. I had no anger, you know, for him or any feelings whatsoever. Because, I mean, this person just comes into your life. You have no feelings, or it isn't a grudge thing. There's just nothing. There's just, you just have no feeling. I did feel that, I mean, it was premeditated. He did come to the town some weeks before and was looking for where George lived. I mean, he was actually trying to get Paul, but I think he just couldn't find him. So, and he was very sick, very, you know, very florid, schizophrenic. But he was deemed, you know, not guilty by reason of insanity. And I think it should have been guilty but insane. And that's where I think the law, you know, could be changed, because he was treated and then got to a point where they said, well, look, now he's not a threat anymore. He's not a danger anymore. And he was released. And, well, now that he knows what he's doing, maybe then he should be punished. Because they said, you know, he didn't know what he was doing, and therefore you can't hold him and we'll treat him. And so, you know, he became sane. He became, you know, compos mentis. Now he knows. Why don't they then give him a sentence? To me, that's what doesn't seem right to me.
You are in a family that is very famous. It's something you have to live with, the fact that celebrity kind of figures into the delusional or hallucinatory life of some people who are mentally ill, and you become a figure in their delusional world, and the world of their delusions kind of enters your reality if they are prone to violence and can follow through on it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I can't speak for other celebrities, but I know with the Beatles there was, you know, because people listen over and over to music, and, you know, there have been many people who've said, well, you know, that song said this and it told me that. And so, you know, yeah, I mean, there are people who still write to George every day. Right. And I just think, what is wrong with these people?
Just another thing about your husband, George Harrison, when he was facing death. Tell me if this is too melodramatic or not, but it seemed like he was heading in that direction. I mean, at first it was throat cancer, then he was attacked and nearly stabbed to death, and then it was the lung cancer. And it just seemed to be like one thing after another that was threatening his life. Did it feel that way to you, that an almost inevitability that there was going to be something soon?
Well, no, there is inevitability every day from, you know, the minute we're born. And George used to say that, you know, the cause of death is birth. And, you know, it didn't actually feel like that. I mean, you know, our life became more and more meaningful and profound every single day to the end. And I think everybody should wish for a life like that.
Olivia Harrison, thank you so much for talking with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Olivia Harrison wrote the liner notes for the new box set collecting her late husband's recordings from 1976 to 92 from his Dark Horse record label. Here's a song he wrote during the Beatles era, which he performs in the 1991 concert in Japan, which is included in the box set.
Here comes the sun, I say, it's all.